You're listening to Bible Prophecy Daily, a weekday podcast where Bible prophecy matters and matters greatly.
Is the whole 7 years God's wrath? In pre-tribulational theology, they teach that the future seven-year period where all these events are going to unfold within, all that is God's wrath. And really, I think the main reason why they believe that is because they believe that the rapture will happen before the seven-year period. And for some reason, they view the seven-year period as God's wrath. Because, well, I mean, and I also believe this, that after the rapture, immediately after the rapture, that is, the day of the Lord's wrath will begin. Now, some pre-tribs will put a gap between the rapture and the seven-year period. Nevertheless, they believe that the seven-year period is all of God's wrath. And for pre-wrath, we would say no. There is no evidence to have the future seven period all of God's wrath. It's not this constant amorphous kind of all of God's wrath. No, we would say that argue that the church enters into the 7 year period as we have shown, you know, many times, and as I've demonstrated in my book, Antichrist Before the Day of the Lord, what every Christian needs to know about the return of Christ. And so what I've been doing the past couple months, I've been working through this article by Jim McLarty, who critiqued the pre-wrath position in an article, and we've been going through it. And the next section of his article is titled, Is the Whole 7 Years God's Wrath? And that's why I titled my episode today on that, because I want to address his arguments. I think his statements are representative of a lot of pre-tribs, and so I'm going to use his critique as a springboard to address this issue of, is the whole 7 years God's wrath? So I'd like to begin, first of all, and by the way, I'll provide a link in the show notes to his article. Okay, so let's begin with his first statement. He says, the pre-wrath scheme breaks up Daniel's 70th week into distinct sections. And my response is, and why is that a bad thing? It's biblical. It's because Jesus himself broke up the 70th week of Daniel into, quote-unquote, distinct sections. And, for example, Matthew 24, it's interesting he does not address Matthew 24. If you're going to talk about the 70th week of Daniel and events that are going to happen within the 70th week of Daniel, why aren't you going to Matthew 24? Well, there's a reason why. Because Jesus breaks up the 70th week of Daniel into distinct sections. So that would, you know, contradict his statement. So why does pre-wrath break up the 70th week of Daniel into distinct sections? Well, you have to begin with the reference point. And this is, by the way, this is something we can agree with pre-tribulationists, which I find kind of ironic because they themselves break up the 70th week of Daniel. So in other words, in Matthew 24, 25, okay, Matthew 24, verse 15, let me just turn there, it reads, Jesus says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, of course, he's referencing back to Daniel chapter 9 here, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, and then he says, let those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Verse 15, here, Jesus is referring back to the 70th week of Daniel. Isn't that interesting that McLarty, again, he does not, after the statement in this article, he doesn't reference Matthew 24. He doesn't reference Matthew 24, and yet that's where you want to go. That's where Jesus himself is referring to the 70th week of Daniel. And he's drawing from a pivotal event in the seven-year period, and that's at the midpoint. It's called the Abomination of Desolation. And pre-tribs agree with this. This is what's so dumbfounding of McLarty's statement. So Jesus splits up the 70th week of Daniel. At the midpoint, you have the Abomination of Desolation. Okay, so right there, you have to begin there. Matthew 24, verse 15, Jesus referencing a crucial event that's going to happen at the midpoint. Okay, so we have that event. The Abomination of Desolation is going to happen at the midpoint. McLarty fails to recognize what happens before the midpoint. Well, look again, Matthew 24. So Matthew 24, the event that happens before the midpoint is the Abomination of Desolation. Or, I mean, the beginning of birth pains. All right, so you have Matthew 24, verse 8. It says, all these things are the beginning of birth pains. He's talking about, you know, you will hear of wars, rumors of wars, right? Make sure that you are not alarmed. It talks about nation rising up against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There'll be famines and earthquakes in various places. And he says, all these are the beginning of birth pains, okay? And by the way, this corresponds with the first three seals in the book of Revelation. So you have the beginning of birth pains. Now, some people will argue that it happens before the 70th week of Daniel. And I'm not, by the way, I'm not averse to it as beginning before the 70th week of Daniel, but I am inclined to see the beginning of birth pains as happening in the first half. So when McLarty says there's no evidence to break up, he's just simply wrong. He doesn't even touch this. And then you have in verses 9 through 14, you have what I've argued is the Great Tribulation. And we know that it's the Great Tribulation because it's a summary of the Great Tribulation. In verse 15, you have the oon, the Greek term oon, it's referencing back. It's inferential. And if one knows Greek, they'll appreciate what I'm saying here, because in verse 15, basically at the end of verse 14, you have the end of the body of the Olive Discourse. And then in verse 15, Jesus basically now gives further implication of events and how these events are going to come about. I've argued this in my book. We've covered this before. So you have the beginning birth pains happening before the midpoint. And then what happens after the midpoint? Well, you have an expression here. It says in verse 21, it says, "For then there will be great tribulation unlike anything that has ever happened from the beginning of the world until now, or ever will be." That's where we get the expression, the great tribulation. Jesus explicitly says that from the point of the abomination desolation, there's going to be a period of great tribulation, okay? And of course, that's obviously, he's associating that with the Antichrist. Now, he's using an expression here as a personification, the abomination desolation spoken of by the Daniel standing in the holy place. So he's personifying this Antichrist figure through the abomination desolation. No one disagrees with that, at least futurists. Even pre-tribs agree with that Matthew 24 verse 15 is speaking of the Antichrist. And then this Antichrist, the Great Tribulation, is being associated with the Antichrist. The Great Tribulation is being associated with the Antichrist. So this is interesting because McLarty says, he says, quote, "I am not convinced that this scheme is biblically consistent. First off, the biblical authors never refer to the Great Tribulation as Antichrist tribulation. That's a construct unique to the pre-wrath position." And he says, "The Bible simply describes the rise, rule, and destruction of Antichrist as events that occur during the seventh week of Daniel." McLarty could not be more mistaken. The biblical writers do associate the Antichrist with great persecution, suffering, tribulation. Again, right here in Matthew 24, he doesn't even touch this at all. The abomination of desolation, the Antichrist figure is associated with, there's a cause and effect action here. You can't miss it. This is why Jesus says that when the abomination desolation happens, in verse 15, he says there's a warning. Flee to the mountains, right? He associates the he states the cause and effect action. The abomination of desolation will cause a great tribulation. Okay? This is not God's wrath. Notice this is not God's wrath here. This is the wrath being committed by the act or the person through the abomination of desolation. So McLarty could not be more mistaken, and which is why he completely avoids this text, because Matthew 24, verses 15 to 22 explicitly associates the Antichrist with the Great Tribulation. Another reason why he's mistaken is he argues that the Antichrist is not involved with Great Tribulation persecution. Again, all one has to do is turn to Revelation 13. I mean, I'm not going to take my time to read it here, but all of Revelation 13 is all about the Antichrist is persecuting. It's persecuting God's people. Clardy says that the Bible simply, quote, simply just describes the rise and the rule and the destruction of Antichrist as events that occurred during the 70th week of Daniel. Well, yeah, but what is the destruction of the Antichrist? He's trying to destroy God's people. So it's amazing. He doesn't cite Revelation 13. He's highly selective. Revelation 13, you cannot read Revelation 13. You cannot read Matthew 24. And you cannot read 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and walk away and say, oh, Antichrist has nothing to do with persecuting Christians. Okay, now getting back to the whole, you know, distinct section. So we have Matthew 24. We have the beginning birth pains, this period of beginning birth pains happening before the midpoint. And then at the midpoint, we have a new section called the abomination desolation. And then that will cause this great tribulation, which we call the Antichrist great tribulation, because it's caused by the Antichrist. It's not caused by God. Now, don't get me wrong, I believe in the sovereignty of God, and I don't believe this dualistic heresy that there's two sovereign independent powers out there, and Satan and God are fighting it out and all this stuff. No, God is sovereign, and even though God, in his infinite wisdom, in his infinite love, he has ordained the last generation of the church to undergo its worst persecution. So even though it's orchestrated by the Antichrist, God is ultimately in control. It's just like in Job. God gives Job permission, or gives Satan permission to persecute Job, right, and his family and his whole life. First of all, God is in control, but Satan was an agent of God, and to use Satan to test Job's faith. God can do whatever he wants. He can use, and that's why Job says, God can use evil or good to fulfill his purposes. And so, by the way, we see that in the book of Revelation, in the seals. We're going to see these malevolent creatures will go out and wreak havoc, and yet Christ is in control. He is sovereign. And it's interesting in Job, right? Job, Satan did not have complete unabated freedom, right? He could not take the life of Job. Well, isn't it fascinating that in Matthew 24, the great tribulation, Satan, Antichrist, wrath against God's people, it's not completely unabated. Why? Because it says in verse 22, it says, and if those days had not been cut short, no one would be saved. Now, that's a bad rendering. Actually, should be no one would be delivered or no flesh would be saved. It's not talking about spiritual. It's in the context of believing flesh. And it says, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Now, of course, it's God, right? It's not Satan. If Satan, Antichrist, if they had it their own way, every Christian would be exterminated. But God in his sovereignty, there is a point in which it says no more. And he will deliver a remnant. So God is sovereign, even in times of that the church is being persecuted under the evil person, under Satan, under the Antichrist. And we also see that in the fifth seal, the fifth seal martyrs. Notice it says in Revelation 6:9, it says, now when the Lamb opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been violently killed because of the word of God and because of their testimony they had given. And then they said, they cried out with a loud voice, how long, sovereign master, holy and true, before you judge those who live on the earth and avenge our blood? And the divine answer is that each of them was given a long white robe and they were told to rest for a little longer until the full number was reached of both their fellow servants and their brothers who were going to be killed just as they had been. God is sovereign, and we should not question God when God's people, when his people, he allows his people to be persecuted. He has good purposes in it. These are not purposeless tragedies. There's a theology out there that will teach that that when you're going under trials and persecution, God has nothing to do with it. Well, I'm sorry, but that's the worst pastoral theology you can give someone. Basically, you're saying God has no control over your circumstances. No, you have to trust that God has good purposes. You may not understand them, but you have to trust them. And that's, by the way, that is because, as I mentioned in this text, it says that that God would judge them until the full number was reached. God has a sovereign timing. He has sovereign purposes. And, you know, this isn't just in the last book of the Bible, in the book of Revelation. You find God's sovereignty, his character, consistent throughout the whole Bible, even in the first book of the Bible, where in Genesis 50:18 and 50:19, Joseph, he says, well, in verse 19, he says, you know, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? And then he says, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, for a good purpose, so that he could preserve the lives of many people, so you can see this day. In other words, Joseph recognizes God's sovereign character, and he recognizes that what he went through, imprisonment, as a slave, all that, God did it. Ultimately, it was God who did it, but he did it and he worked his will out through these evil agents. But it was for a good purpose, not an evil purpose. It was for a good purpose. So you have to understand, if we are the last generation of the church and we find ourselves in the Great Tribulation, Antichrist putting, you know, believers left and right, they're putting them to death. Or he's putting them to death. We have to embrace the sovereignty of God and not lose hope and understand our hope is this, that God is a good God and he's an almighty God. That is, we trust that God has a good purpose in our suffering. If we don't get that, we will go through life defeated. We truly will. Okay, so let's get back to Matthew 24. Okay, so we have the beginning of birth pains, the first half, and then we have the abomination of desolation at the midpoint, and then we have then it will begin a great tribulation, starting at the midpoint, and sometime during the second half of the 7-year period, those days are going to be cut short, and it says they're going to be cut short with the return of Jesus in the clouds. There's going to be a resurrection, and I believe that's referring to the rapture there, the gathering of the elect in verse 31. We've addressed that many times. And that will be the the beginning of the day of the Lord's wrath. okay, which will go to for the remaining part of the 7-year period. And actually, I argue that it goes for an extra 30 days after the 7-year period. But the point here is that when McLarty says that it's wrong that the for pre-rathers to break up the 70th week of Daniel, he's wrong. You know, he's just asserting it here. I'm actually showing biblical data. Here it is, Matthew 24. You can't get around it. Is Jesus himself breaks up the 70th week of Daniel into these periods of time. Okay, next, this is what he says. He says the first half, this is what he thinks pre-wrath teaches. The first half they deem the Great Tribulation, while the second half encompasses the Day of the Lord. Yeah, I'm going to repeat that again. This is what Jim McLarty states. The first he says this is what pre-wrath teaches. The first half they deem the Great Tribulation, while the second half encompasses the Day of the Lord. Folks, this is proof that Jim McLarty has not read one single book on pre-wrath. Because if he had, he would not make this blunderous statement. Anyone remotely familiar with pre-wrath knows that pre-wrath does not have the Great Tribulation in the first half. It begins at the midpoint. This is definitional. This is definitional of pre-wrath, in that the Great Tribulation begins at the midpoint and then it's cut short at some point. We don't know the day or the hour, but it's cut short with the day of the Lord's wrath. So when I read this, I read it like 2 or 3 times to make sure like I'm reading this correctly. I mean, this kind of gives it away. He has not read pre-wrath literature. Yeah, he's referenced pre-wrath literature. He'll go to like a page. I'm sure he's gone to the scripture index of a book, whether it's my book or Van Campen's book or Rosenthal's book, and he has, you know, seen what we've written on maybe a certain topic. Okay, so in the next subsection of this section, in fact, he only mentions one subsection. For example, okay, we've just covered the two paragraphs here in the first part of this section. Is the whole 7 years God's wrath? And like I said, it's like, well, the go-to passage is Matthew 24. He completely ignores it. What he does then, he immediately goes to the seals. And this is what he says. He says the pre-wrath advocates point to the sixth seal in Revelation 6 as the point where God's wrath is unleashed. Okay, I'm sorry, right there. He's wrong again. The sixth seal does not unleash the wrath of God. Okay, if he had read pre-wrath literature, he would understand that pre-wrath views the sixth seal is the celestial disturbance is it's a harbinger. It's signaling that the wrath of God is about to be poured out. The celestial disturbances themselves is not wrath. In fact, the church is going to be here for that, and we are exempted from wrath, and that's why we know, one of the reasons we know that the celestial disturbance is not God's wrath. If you look at chapter 21, Jesus says that when you see these celestial disturbances, you know, stand up, for your redemption draws near. The redemption here, why are Christians supposed to stand up and lift up their head? Well, because deliverance is coming. It's coming in the sky. When Jesus arrives on the sky, you're going to have the resurrection. And of course, the rapture, those who are alive up to the parousia. Okay? So next he says, here we find an area of agreement. Inasmuch as this outpouring of wrath comes from God and the Lamb, the church must not be present. And then he says, well, let me just stop right there. Again, he mischaracterizes the pre-wrath. And then he says, Christ will not pour out his wrath on his bride, his own body. And Paul wrote that we who are in Christ are not appointed unto wrath, 1 Thessalonians 5:9. Okay. Then he says, however, where we differ is that the pre-wrath advocates argue that the preceding seals in Revelation 6 are all representative of Antichrist's wrath. not God's. Therefore, the church will endure the things described in those five seals. Okay, and then he gives the text in Revelation 5. Basically gives Revelation 5 and then the first couple of verses, verse 6. And then McLarty says, he says, details matter. God has a scroll in his own hands. Yep, that's right. He says, it is sealed with seven seals and written on the front and back. Whatever comes from this scroll is God's doing. Yep, that's right. Satan doesn't operate in an autonomous fashion. And then he says, no one in heaven, on earth, or under the earth is worthy to open it. Jesus himself advances and takes the scroll. Consequently, worship breaks out. The Lamb breaks the first seal, and Antichrist goes forth conquering and to conquer. It says, through the balance of chapter 5, Jesus opens each successive seal, bringing about war, famine, death, and finally the wrath of the Lamb. He says, McLarty says, there is no hint or indication that the first five seals are anything other than God's doing, unleashed by Christ's authority. He's confusing two categories here. Again, this is strange coming from Jim McLarty. Jim McLarty is Calvinistic, and he believes in the unadulterated sovereignty of God. And so he himself should actually recognize that God, throughout the ages, is always ultimately in control. And he will be in control during the Great Tribulation as well. This is why Jesus opens up these seals. Satan is not operating autonomously. They can only do it by the will of God. And here, the will of Christ, who is initiating these seals. You know, they argue that, well, because Jesus himself opens up the seals, therefore it must be God's wrath. Of course, that's not true at all. I demonstrated that. You can't show that. Unless, and I know they don't want to be accused of this, otherwise, if they're saying that God can't be in control during the persecution of God's people, then they're going to fall into the heresy of dualism. That's the ancient heresy of dualism, where you have, again, Satan and God, they're independent powers, and Satan operates on his own, okay? And God is, you know, doesn't have sovereign power over Satan. You got to be very careful not to fall into that dualistic heresy. Listen, all bad things that happen in this world do not happen outside of the will of God. And we're going to see that even during the Great Tribulation, the worst persecution that the church ever experienced, still, God will be in control. And he will judge. He will judge those that... it's sort of like the nations when in the Old Testament, right? Talks about that God raises up, sovereignly raises up. He raises up nations to... to judge Israel, right? And they'll judge Israel. And then what does God do? Then he turns around and he judges those nations that judged Israel, because God is just. He can do that. So he says that, you know, there's no evidence here. I explained that in the first four horsemen seals, it's just the opposite. You don't have any hint of God's wrath in these texts as far as, this eschatological Day of the Lord's wrath. And I explained that the first four seals, they're natural events. They're natural events. I mean, don't misunderstand when I say natural. Obviously, God, we're not saying that, you know, Mother Nature is doing this. No, I mean, God obviously is orchestrating this, okay? But they're in contrast to the supernatural judgment elements that you see in the trumpet judgments and the bowl judgments. A stark difference. So you have the first four seals. These are going to purify the church before Christ returns. Okay, and that's one of the main purposes for the Great Tribulation is to test our faith. And so I responded to this ignorant claim by pre-tribulationists that will say that, you know, well, God would never bring tribulation to the church. You know, well, I mean, look at first. 1 Peter 4:17, for it's time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? But the fifth seal is, I mean, this is definitive. The fifth seal demonstrates unequivocally that the wrath of God has not begun. And this is why pre-tribulationists run away from the fifth seal. It's deeply problematic. In this episode, I demonstrate that the fifth seal, it shows the fifth seal depicts martyrs showing that the martyrs themselves, they recognize that the day of the Lord's wrath has not come. I read that earlier, but let me go to there. Revelation 6. So it reads, Now when the Lamb opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been violently killed because here's the reason why they were killed: by the word of God, and because of the testimony they had given. Of course, that's not unique. It's not going to be unique there. It's happening even today, right? In verse 10, here's the kicker. Verse 10, they cried out with a loud voice, "How long, Sovereign Master, holy and true, before you judge those who live on the earth and avenge your blood?" Notice, the martyrs themselves, they know that the wrath of God has not started yet. That's why he says, "When will you judge?" They know it's in the future still. And then notice, just to corroborate this, in verse 11, the divine answer is, each of them was given a long white robe. They're not wearing it. They're just given it, right? They're going to be wearing it in Revelation 7, which is a depiction of the rapture. And they were told to rest for a little longer until the full number was reached of both their fellow servants and their brothers who were going to be killed just as they had been. So the divine answer confirms the martyrs' understanding, and that is, wait a little bit longer. The judgment, the wrath of God is coming. Just wait a bit. Okay? And then, of course, we have the sixth seal. The sixth seal, of course, drawing from the celestial disturbances, is drawing from Joel 2:30-31, that explicitly state that the celestial disturbances is going to happen before the wrath of God, the day of the Lord. And then you have Luke 21, right? And Matthew 24 corroborates this, that the day of the Lord happens after the great tribulation. In Matthew 24, it says, immediately after the tribulation of those days. And then, of course, you have, you know, the seventh seal. Well, let me just stop there for a moment. You have an interlude. Before the last seal is opened, before the scroll is opened, you have a conspicuous break in the narrative. You have two groups of people being delivered. 144,000 Jews are sealed on earth. And then you have this innumerable multitude from every tribe, nation, people, tongue. And they've appeared out of the Great Tribulation. It actually says, out of the Great Tribulation, in heaven. Now, I'm sorry, but that can be none other than the raptured people of God. And why are these two groups of people being delivered at this point? Because the judgment of God, the wrath of God, is going to be pronounced and executed when the seventh seal is opened. It's a beautiful consistency. In fact, I often like to say there's a progression towards God's wrath. The fifth seal promises God's wrath. The sixth seal portends God's wrath. The interlude in Revelation 7 protects from God's wrath. And then the seventh seal pronounces God's wrath. And so this whole notion that the first six seals are God's wrath is just, it's unfounded. It simply is. He says that, and then he says, not a word is said about the first five seals being Antichrist's great tribulation. Actually, yeah, it does. Go to my book, Antichrist Before the Day of the Lord. I make a pretty good case showing that the fifth seal, the martyrs, is a result of the fourth seal. One can make a case also that the first three seals is an expression of the wars, the rumors of wars, and the result of war is being caused by the Antichrist. Now, I don't believe that's referring to Antichrist in his revealed state. I'm sorry, in his unrevealed state at the midpoint, because Paul says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 that the Antichrist is going to be a revelation. Everyone's going to, you know, this revelation of the Antichrist. But he is going to be coming on the scene before that. And I believe that during the first half, he's going to be in this incognito type of, you know, he's in this unrevealed state. And I think he's going to be a political ruler in some respect, and he will have a power base of some nations, but it's only going to be into the midpoint in which his revelation occurs, and the whole world is going to be astonished, it says in Revelation 13. Okay, so just finishing up here, he says, the very least we can say about the seals is that whatever tribulation they produce, it is coming directly from Christ, under his authority and sovereign hand from first to last. Again, McLarty is confusing categories here. He's making this leap in logic. If the text expresses God's initiative or Christ's initiative in this case, therefore this must be God's judgment. Well, again, I could just go back to the book of Job. It was God's initiative. It was his purpose, right? But he was persecuted. He was put to the test, right, by Satan himself. Well, just like during the Great Tribulation, it's going to be the same. God is going to be in control. Christ is not going to be Satan. Satan is not initiating these seals because, remember, Satan is under the direct sovereignty control of God. Satan can only do what he has freedom to do. In fact, we see that also. I want to mention 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Same thing here. It talks about, for that day will not arrive until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction. Verse 6. And so you know what holds him back, so that he will be revealed in his own time. For the hidden power of lawlessness is already worked. However, the one who holds him back would do so until he is taken out of the way. Now, once again, here, if Satan had his own way, he would have been revealed a long time ago, or possessed an Antichrist figure and exterminated Christians a long time ago. And if he had his way, he would have had Herod kill the baby Jesus. But because God is sovereign, he has his purposes and why he will initiate these trials in the lives of believers. It is God's sovereign timing. It is God's sovereign action in which he will bring about these events. So when Jesus opens up these seals, he's the only one worthy. Satan is not sovereign, and therefore he is not worthy. And I'm not sure why Mr. McLarty does not understand that. And we can be thankful that it is Jesus who is sovereignly opening up these seals, and it is not Satan. Yes, these seals initiate and they allow for these creatures, these evil creatures, to do Satan's bidding. But ultimately, we know that God's will is what controls Satan, and we can be thankful that there are not, again, two sovereign powers in this world. Oh yeah, he also says, and if that is the case, the church cannot be here when the first seal is open and the successive waves of increasing woe from God occur on the earth. Again, as I demonstrated here, that's not the case, because the church will be here. God has ordained in his sovereignty, he has ordained that the church not just suffer persecution right now, the beginning of the church, all through church age, right? Was God not in control? During the Great Tribulation, it's not going to be nothing new. What is going to be new, though, is the scope. It's going to be the scope of persecution, martyrdom. That's going to be different. But it's still, God has ordained that this time is going to be the worst, and then Christ is going to pierce through those clouds. And and he is going to vindicate his people. He is going to judge the people, judge Satan, judge Antichrist, judge the nations who have persecuted his people, who have shed the blood of his own people. Jesus not returning in some secret rapture. No. He is coming back in glory and power, and the whole world is going to witness that. The whole world is going to witness that God is going to deliver his people out from within the midst of the Great Tribulation. And we can thank God. Our hope, our blessed hope, is not a rapture, let alone some secret rapture. No, our hope is joining with Christ, being with Christ, fellowshipping with Christ in our new glorified bodies. I'm looking forward to that day. But you know what? God just may have our generation experience, or be the last generation of the church and experience these awful events. But these awful events, as bad as they are, they will test our faith. And that's one of the main purposes, divine purposes, why God puts us through trials, is to test our faith. But ultimately, the book of Revelation, it's ultimately not about the return of Christ per se. It's about overcoming the Antichrist. All through the book of Revelation, the emphasis is on the church, not quote-unquote tribulation saints who are left behind, you know, after the rapture. No. The message of the book of Revelation is to the church. It's to the church. And is to be an overcomer. This message is for every single one of us who is part of the church. Some of the most severe warnings in the Bible from Christ have to do with this subject. Let me tell you, Satan is hard at work in dismissing these warnings. You have preterists who say, oh, these warnings are not for us. They happen. These events happened in the first century. You have pre-tribs teaching, oh, no, they're not for you. They're for tribulation saints. We're going to be raptured out of here before all that. You have historicists dismissing this message, saying, oh, no, those warnings are just kind of amorphous, kind of general for all Christians throughout the church age. They're not specifically for the last generation of the church. And then you have one of the most dangerous teachings, I think, is this pan-tribulationist. Don't worry about yourself. Don't concern yourself. It's all going to pan out in the end. Don't get all worked up about this. You know what? Satan loves those messages because it keeps the church away from vigilance.
Thanks for listening to Bible Prophecy Daily. We hope you learned something valuable today. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode.